您现在收听的是由神经现实出品的播客节目《神经漫游》。神经现实专注于神经科学、认知科学和精神病学等领域的深度报道和前沿解读。关注微信公众号“神经现实”，获取更多新鲜资讯。
欢迎大家来到新一期的神经现实播客栏目《神经漫游》。
Welcome to the new episode of Neuromancy. Neuromancy is the podcast of New Reality.A non-profit organization aiming to promote the knowledge of neuroscience, cognitive science, and psychiatry.
我是怡婷 I'm Veronica, a postdoc at Mike Garvin Institute for Brain Research at MIT.
我是子谦 I'm Ariel, an undergrad at UCL, studying psychology and language sciences.
这期节目我们有幸邀请到了神经科学期刊 Neuron 的科学编辑 TedDobie 来给我们聊聊他的学术和编辑生涯。
Today, we are very honored to have Ted Dobie, the scientific editor of Neuron, as our guest. He will share with us his work as an editor and his views and passion for neuroscience.
Ted Dobie received his PhD from the University of British Columbia, studying molecular and cellular mechanisms of synapse formation and plasticity under Dr. Anne Mary Crick.For his postdoctoral studies at the Stanley Center for Psychiatric Research at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard, he worked with Dr. Guoping Feng, looking at mouse models of heritable neurodevelopmental and neuropsychiatric disorders.
He joined Elsevier in 2015 as scientific editor for the translational research journal eBiomedicine, a joint venture of Cell Press and The Lancet. Ted moved to Neuron in 2017,where he enjoys working with authors on molecular, cellular, disease-related, and systems neuroscience papers.
All right. Now, why don't we just dive right into it?
Sure.
So I'm personally very interested, actually, this part of a question that is about editing as a career. So
okay.
Could you please describe your current work to us? Like, what would be a typical day for you?
Right. So I'm an editor for Neuron. I've been with Neuron for just about 5 years now. And so a typical day at Neuron looks, as you would imagine, we read a lot of papers. So we get roughly 2,100 submissions a year, and that's not including pre-submissions. So there are seven people on the team. So that equals, you know,we each get, you know, one or two or three or four new papers to read a day. So usually the first part of my day is kind of administrative things, answering emails. We get a lot of emails from authors and reviewers, and we have to keep tabs on, you know, how reviews are going. And when we receive reviews, we have to kind of collate that information and make a decision based on the reviews. And then also first thing in the morning, we get what we call the EdPack, which is all the papers that have come in since the previous day. And as a team, we all comment on the EdPack. So the EdPack is a list of titles and abstracts of the papers. And we just kind of get our gut impression. It's not kind of anything that is meant to...Be binding decision about the submission. And then at that point, we can claim papers, or we can say we have conflicts of interest with the paper and we shouldn't handle it. So if you're really interested in a paper, you can say, I want to handle this paper, and it'll be assigned to you. And so at that stage, every editor or every paper gets assigned to a single editor.And that editor will read the paper in detail. And kind of depending on our experience, and, you know, how well we know the field, we'll consult with our colleagues on our thoughts on the paper. We usually take detailed notes on the paper, do a thorough literature review on the paper, kind of discuss what the advance is, what the experimental pros and cons of the paper are, that sort of thing.So I would say for every paper that I'm assigned, it takes about, you know, 45 minutes to read the paper, half an hour to do a lit review. And then if we decide to send it out for review, it takes, you know, an additional good amount of time to find reviewers who don't have conflicts, who might be well suited to review the paper. So a typical day is a lot of reading, a lot of chatting with our colleagues about what we think about each paper. So that's kind of the day-to-day. We also have editorial meetings twice a week where we discuss kind of larger issues. If we have a complicated case, if we have a rebuttal, we discuss rebuttals regularly. So that's when a paper is rejected and the author comes back and says, please don't reject my paper. we discuss those. We spend a lot of time discussing those. And we discuss kind of other kind of journal strategy things. So we also organize conferences. We do outreach with different labs and authors. We do site visits. We do special issues. We commission reviews, perspectives, and primers. So we spend a lot of time thinking about kind of not the actual research papers, but a lot of the other stuff that we publish in the journal. So, you know, it's a lot of reading, a lot of communicating with each other. We really are a super collaborative team. That's kind of the gist of it. Yeah.
That's very interesting. Then what part do you love most about your job?
There are many things that I love about my job. You know, I think, you know, as a grad student or a postdoc, you tend to be pretty focused on one specific problem. You know, you're writing your dissertation on, I don't know, whatever, the visual system, retinotopic maps or something like that. But as an editor for a journal, you read about everything. So I learned more about neuroscience in the first year as an editor at Neuron than I did for my entire previous academic career, I would say. And it's not just learning a lot. It's learning the cool, hot new stuff, the stuff before most people get to see it. So that's really kind of exciting to be at the forefront of the field and get to see, you know, the sorts of questions that people are interested in. I really also love, you know, my team. I think kind of above all, we're very collaborative. You know, again, as a grad student or a postdoc, you're often doing experiments by yourself and it's can sometimes be kind of lonely. But we really, you know, we all have one shared goal, and that's to put out, you know, the coolest issue of Neuron we can every 2 weeks. So we're really, you know, dedicated to being, you know, serving our authors really well, making them the highest quality issue we can. There's a real sense of, you're accomplishing something every day towards publishing an issue, whereas, you know, doing bench experiments, it's, you know, sometimes kind of hitting your head against the wall for a long time when things don't work and trying to troubleshoot. But there's a real sense of accomplishment about that. And I also really love just staying connected with the neuroscience community, you know, hearing from authors, hearing about what excites them, hearing about, you know, the concerns they have about, you know, where the field is, where the field's going, the publishing industry. I enjoy staying connected with people who are doing the actual work that's making a difference in neuroscience.
Well, I can tell from your description, you're really passionate about your job. So what is the challenges for you?
The biggest challenge that I briefly alluded to the rebuttal aspect is, so we can't always deliver good news. Unfortunately, you know, sometimes, you know, a lot of the time, unfortunately, we do have to make tough decisions on papers. And, you know, still to this day, I don't relish sending bad news to authors. It's still, you know, something that eats me up a bit. And I think, you know, over time, myself and my colleagues, we try to stay really well grounded in our experiences, you know, as as grad students and postdocs and PIs, you know, we know that people spent a ton of time doing the work, and this could be a big, meaningful impact on their career. And so we try to be compassionate about making the decisions. We don't make them lightly or glibly. We spend a lot of time thinking about them. And, you know, it is still a challenge to send along disappointing news. But I think it, as long as we try to, you know, put ourselves in our author's shoes, we can hopefully make it, you know, disappointing but understandable news, at least, trying to give a clear explanation for the rationale for our decisions.
I think your description, like, made me fell in love with your job. I just want to ask, because I'm a psychology and neuroscience student, yep, as well, and mm-hmm, I get interested in neuroscience because I'm so desperate to know, like, how we think, what we think. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, where did your curiosity and thirst for neuroscience come from?
Pretty much exactly the same thing. Oh. So it was really just just so curious about what made us uniquely human. So I will say, share a story. So when I was in high school, mm-hmm, there was a show that was originally produced by the BBC, but I'm from Canada, and it aired on a Canadian television station. And the show is called The Human Animal by Desmond Morris. And he is a zoologist who was studying human behavior through the lens of having studied animal behavior for his entire career. And he wrote a bunch of books about, you know, human behavior. He wrote The Naked Ape. So I saw that show, and I thought, you know, this is probably too simplistic to kind of boil us down to simply animals. But really, what about us as animals makes us uniquely human? That's the sort of questions that, you know, got me really curious. So, you know, I started reading things by popular science stuff by Oliver Sacks and V.S. Ramachandran. And going into my undergrad, I was kind of convinced I was going to be a neurologist or a psychiatrist to really understand the brain. And where I did my undergraduate education, there was no neuroscience program at the time. So I was doing a bachelor's in biochemistry, and kind of later in my, you know, fourth year of my undergrad, I was taking some electives that were outside the department. So I took an endocrinology elective that obviously talked about, you know, the effect of hormones on the brain and the behavior and physiology. And then I took a seminar course where really there was no syllabus for the seminar course, other than we were to select papers from the recent literature and present them to the rest of the class. And the first paper I selected was a cell paper on circadian oscillations in the suprachiasmatic nucleus and how that affected sleep and behavior. And I thought, okay, this is amazing. If this is what neuroscience research is, this is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I abandoned the psychiatrist neurologist thing. And I thought, you know, to really understand the brain, that's what I want to do for my life, to kind of do these sorts of experiments and just kind of dive deeply into how it all fits together. You know, all spurred initially by watching television.
Great. Yeah. Neuroscience is such a fascinating subject that we can devote our lives in.
Yeah.
And following up, I was wondering, how does your neuroscientific perspective impact the way you live your life and perceive the world now?
So a few years ago, you know, my answer would have been kind of more philosophical about, mm-hmm, you know, how we interact with each other and how we can use neuroscience to understand people's motivations and behaviors and, you know, that sort of thing. But mm-hmm, but now my answer is going to be much more personal. I have a 4-year-old daughter at home. And you know, the things we learn about, in textbooks and the literature about neurodevelopment, you know, I can see these things happening before my eyes. You know, you see, you know, typical milestones of like motor development or language development or, you know, abstract thinking. And it's really, you know, it's, as I said, it's very personal, but it's really just kind of, you know, oh yeah, I read about that, you know, 10 years ago when I was learning about how the motor system develops or whatever. You know, and I'm not saying we perform experiments on my daughter, but it's really interesting to see, you know, the things that we learn from psychology, you know, 100 years ago on classical conditioning, things like, you know, rewarding and aversive stimuli, they are particularly impactful for a four-year-old. And it's also, you know, it's really cool to see the things that physiological stressors, how they impact her behavior. Like when she really is really hungry or really tired or really has to go to the bathroom, she's going to be in a bad mood. So we know we have to, you know, meet those physiological needs to impact her behavior. And, you know, that this is all neuroscience. So, you know, I could go off a little bit more generally, but I think that's probably the best example that I can give right now. Yeah,
that's very interesting, because I saw a lot of like a developmental psychologists do also do some experiment on their younger daughters because of out of curiosity.
Yeah, don't tell my wife.
So I can see that neuroscience is already part of your life or your family life as a whole. Mm-hmm. So let's talk more about neuroscience. So mm-hmm. we have some questions in neuroscience in general. So really curious about your answers. So this question I'm also personally very interested is, are there any areas of research in neuroscience that are less well recognized as to their possible importance?
Yeah. Yeah, no, this is a great question. I think, you know, my feeling is that it's not as less well recognized as it used to be. There are certainly more people working on it, but I think the connection between the mind and the body is probably one of the fields I find most exciting to read about. And it's just beginning to be studied in detail. So we know that, you know, brain states like stress and reward can influence the immune system and can contribute to, you know, outcomes of diseases like cancer. We know that the immune system can influence the brain, you know, with things like chronic inflammation being a risk factor for depression and other neuropsychiatric disorders. We're seeing how microbes in our guts affect behavior and, you know, neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's disease. We can see how breathing and mindfulness can affect mood. So I think, you know, just understanding the brain as a part of an organism is important. And that organism as part of a system, a social structure, or, you know, as some other kind of ethological system is, you know, hugely important. I think we're seeing more and more in basic neuroscience research, at least, using kind of ethologically relevant paradigms. We're not, you know, running rats through mazes. We're kind of observing them in more naturalistic environments and you know, giving them tasks that are much more complex, but kind of give insights into what is really influencing how the animal is thinking. You know, at Neuron, I handle a lot of disease related papers. Just kind of that's where my interest has gone to over the years. We're also seeing, I think, a growing appreciation for how, you know, juvenile and adolescent and adult and old age disorders of the nervous system can have, you know, very early neurodevelopmental origins. You know, for example, well, we know schizophrenia is highly heritable, and there are a number of risk genes that have been implicated in schizophrenia risk, you know, but that person doesn't develop schizophrenia until, you know, late adolescence or early adulthood. Despite their genotype being the same for their entire life. So we're getting kind of more insight into how those, you know, those genetic differences among folks can, you know, not manifest overtly behaviorally into later life, but could potentially be influencing neurodevelopmental trajectories that ultimately lead to the disease in later life. And, you know, we're seeing, you know, the effects of early life experiences, including early life adversity, on subsequent, you know, adult behaviors, you know, risk for mental health disorders or substance abuse disorders, and effects of things like socioeconomic status and opportunities that folks have in life that other folks don't have, and how that can overall affect brain development and later life behavior. So, you know, I think these things are areas that I'm really excited about and see growing more and more.
Great. Then to follow up this, so I think we have a lot of questions that need to be addressed. So, but what do you think are the most pressing questions in neuroscience?
Yeah. this is, you know, this is a tricky question. So I've talked a lot about kind of understanding the brain, kind of how it naturally works under, you know, how we make decisions and how we learn and how we develop kind of skilled motor movements and how we develop language. But I also mentioned that I, you know, handle a lot of disease papers. And, you know, so I see that the most pressing questions in neuroscience, and I'm biased about this, as being disease related, because, you know, we don't really have any effective treatments for psychiatric or neurological diseases. You know, we have some of the same things that have been around since the 50s. You know, we have drugs for schizophrenia that work on dopamine receptors, and we don't really have any idea how they work. They're also not super effective. You know, we have SSRIs and SNRIs for antidepressants for major depression. We don't know how they work. They only work on a small subset of patients. You know, once people see psychiatrists, they're kind of like, oh, well, we'll try this drug. If it doesn't work after a month, we'll try another drug. It's kind of hit and miss. You know, we don't have any disease modifying therapies for Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's. And, you know, as we've seen, kind of, you know, the pandemic has laid bare that mental health is a crisis facing society as a whole. So, you know, that's an extremely pressing issue. I think we need to, you know, better understand what's going on in the brain that is leading to people having neuropsychiatric disorders, and then we can, you know, go towards better treating them. You know, and we also see, you know, as the population is aging, we're, you know, people are getting older. There are more and more people who are going to be living, you know, into their 80s, 90s, and hundreds. And as we know, many of these neurological diseases are their main risk factors age. So we're going to see a huge cliff that we're going to come to, where we're going to have tons and tons of people who are going to have Alzheimer's disease and are going to be, you know, untreated. And we simply have no good way of taking care of these folks. So, you know, I think there are some really fundamental questions about understanding the brain that could ultimately help us understand what's going wrong in the brain to help folks. But, you know, if we kind of take a step back and think, well, if we understand what's going wrong in folks' brains who have mental illness or a neurological disease, could that also help us inform what's normally happening in a brain to help us properly make decisions or whatever it is. Yeah.
That's a really great point. I think I really wish maybe the world wish to know what's going on with us, our brain, and how we can better treat it in the future.
Yeah.
So yeah, but I think as an editor, it's that's been very exciting for you because you're the forefront who can witness the whole process where all this very, very pressing issue can be properly addressed.
Yeah, hope so.
So yeah. Okay, so let's switch gear a little bit. So I have another question. So while looking back, we can witness the heyday of many like molecular neuroscience and the circular neuroscience and system neuroscience. Now we can see many interdisciplinary research that is emerging, for example, the artificial intelligence or deep learning to help understand our brain. So how do you like interpret these connections between neuroscience and other fields of knowledge? And how do you think they can help each other to better help us understand?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And, you know, I'll start with, you know, specifically you mentioned artificial intelligence. So I'll start with that. I think, you know, initial artificial intelligence, I think was, you know, kind of started from computer science and has been informed by neuroscience over the years. And I think the greatest potential for artificial intelligence is much stronger collaborations between computer scientists, computational neuroscience, and lab neuroscientists. You know, it may be true that some parts of computations in the brain are sort of computer-like, but I think it's a bit premature to say that we understand how a brain works at the level of detail that we need to say that it could be replicated by a machine. So I think kind of an appreciation for how messy biological systems are can help computer scientists design better artificial intelligence systems. And then, you know, the flip side of that is we learn a lot about how computations are performed, you know, at the single cell or circuit level from artificial intelligence, you know, deep learning, neural networks, all of these buzzwords. And that can, I think, ultimately lead to testable hypotheses. And so, you know, I see the greatest potential for collaboration between people working on artificial intelligence and fundamental neuroscience researchers. And then kind of getting back to the broader question about how neuroscience kind of can affect other fields of knowledge, you know, again, I'm going to go back to my bias here, but I think neuroscience can really influence or at least inform pretty much everything that we think about. And Ariel, you mentioned this, you know, coming from a psychology background, I think neuroscience evolved out of psychology with strong influence from philosophy. So we as neuroscientists, we have, I think, an appreciation of asking the questions about, you know, what is the nature of evidence or what is the nature of causality or what is, you know, these kind of philosophical questions that can kind of permeate other sciences. And I also kind of alluded to it, you know, earlier, but there's neuroscience in the appreciation of art and literature and, you know, what do we find beautiful? Our brain is telling us what is beautiful. You know, I alluded to it earlier as well that, you know, there's neuroscience in cancer therapy. You know, if a patient is agitated or stressed or doesn't have psychosocial supports, we know that their treatment response is not going to be as good as someone who has a rich social safety net. We know that, you know, their subjective measures of pain are going to be higher than folks who have, you know, more support. And so that's neuroscience. Psychological safety and mental health is involved, you know, in cancer therapy. There's, you know, there's neuroscience in cardiovascular disease. We know that shift workers or those that are sleep deprived have higher risk for heart attacks and stroke. We know there's neuroscience in infectious disease. There's, you know, neuroimmune interactions that are not only affecting, you know, how a microbe leads to some systemic response in the body, but it can also inform us at a societal level, how we respond to a global pandemic. You know, we can learn about people's biases, their motivations, and perhaps help us influence, you know, policies that can, you know, get us out of trouble better. There's neuroscience and politics and religion and economics. Again, how our biases and motivations are influencing our actions. So, you know, I'm not saying, you know, we need to have neuroscience embedded in microbiology laboratories or cancer laboratories, but I think, you know, an appreciation for how individuals are motivated and how individuals contribute to a society. And, you know, that can help us kind of navigate our future, hopefully a little bit better than without neuroscience.
Neuroscience is really an important discipline that helps us get a better understanding of the world through a human perspective.
Yeah.
A human but scientific perspective. I was wondering, based on your rich experience in academia and editorial observation, what is the current state of neuroscience and how do you envision its future?
This is a really tough question because I think, you know, if we knew what the future of neuroscience is, I think we would not need, you know, grant review panels, or we would not need folks giving out money to come up to the people who are coming up with clever ideas for what to research. But, you know, I come from a molecular and cellular neuroscience background. You know, I studied, you know, how synapses are formed, you know, between an axon and a dendrite. So my view is kind of, you know, we have a ton of data now. We have so much data on, you know, detailed molecular and cellular mechanisms of, you know, how synapses are formed, you know, how synaptic vesicles are released, how axons are patterned in the developing nervous system, you know, synaptic plasticity at the, you know, single synapse level. We have a ton of data now using single cell techniques from, you know, every model organism, from transcriptomics to connectomics. You know, we have work from the mouse up to non-human primates. We have, you know, developmental work from, you know, early gestational humans up to old age. We have, you know, lots of macro scale connectivity data on humans, human imaging studies. We have a lot of behavioral data. We have tons of these observations. We have lots of functional mapping, you know, circuit cracking with channel rhodopsin, that sort of thing. I still don't think we have a unifying theory that puts everything together. You know, that's an ambitious, that's a big ask, obviously. But I think the future of neuroscience is taking the data that we've amassed and using it to ask interesting questions, because, you know, we can generate a lot of cool hypotheses from all the data we have. We just need to think of what the questions are, the right questions to ask are, using the data we have. I think there's still value in simply observing things and descriptive data and using new tools to kind of in an unbiased way, just kind of probe generally things about the brain. But we also need questions that can build on other questions. We get an answer to one question, we can then ask another question and so on to hopefully help us, you know, unify everything. I don't know if that's possible, but you know, I think that's what the future of neuroscience should be, and possibly is asking, you know, using more hypotheses driven questions to interrogate the tons of data we have.
Great. I think That makes so much sense. If we have a framework or a structure of the entire neuroscientific knowledge, it'll help the development of new knowledge and new observations and build up to a hierarchy or a connected network. And my next question is, where do you see the strongest potential for progress and new breakthroughs in the field of neuroscience?
Yeah, so this is going to, I think, come back to a couple earlier answers. I think one of the greatest potentials is the collaboration between neuroscience and artificial intelligence, you know, making our lives easier. I see, you know, huge potential for neuroscience-inspired artificial intelligence and then artificial intelligence informing our understanding of the brain. You know, this is not my expertise, but I think, you know, I definitely see even in the last 5 years, our lives have gotten easier from artificial intelligence. There's still a lot of room to grow in this area. And then again, you know, I'm going to come back to the disease angle, because as I mentioned, I think, you know, psychiatric and neurological diseases are such an unmet clinical need, medical need. So many people are affected, and in terrible ways. You know, the loss of your memory and personality in Alzheimer's disease, that's such a devastating disease. You know, this is essentially losing your personhood, your agency. So how can we better serve all the people that are affected by these diseases? That's pretty much it in a nutshell. Yeah.
Thank you so much. When we were preparing the interview, I looked up on the interview that Neuron did last year with a different scientist, and in particular, a scientist called Abdus Sabur, he commented the field of neuroscience is suffering from an overemphasis on techniques over questions. What do you think about his words? Could this imbalance bring more opportunities than challenges?
So I think you can probably guess my initial answer from a previous answer where I said, you know, we have so much data, now we need to ask the right questions. So on one hand, I very much agree with Ismail Abdus-Sabur. You know, we need to ask, you know, interesting questions that are based on data we already have. However, on the other hand, you know, Sidney Brenner, a very famous scientist, said that progress in science depends on new techniques, new discoveries, and new ideas, probably in that order. So some of the questions, you know, we simply would not have been able to answer without techniques. You know, we wouldn't have known about cell types in the brain as easily as we do now without, you know, single cell technologies. You know, pretty much every neuroscience lab can now do channel rhodopsin circuit cracking. You know, this was not technically feasible for many labs recently. So, you know, I still think we need purely observational, descriptive data sets to then use to generate hypotheses.
Great. That's a lot of explanations on neuroscientific knowledge. And so now we want to move on to the publishing side, the other area that you are specialized on. So what is the evaluation criterion of Neuron, and is it unprecedented methodology or a set of solid experimental results or its potential impact to the world? Are there any preferences in particular topics and considerations beyond the content itself?
Yeah, so this is a It's a pretty tough question to answer, actually. So I've been an editor at Neuron for 5 years, and I think one of the things, you know, that I've learned the most, and one of the things about being part of a collaborative team and always checking in with each other is that we're constantly calibrating what the journal should be interested in. You know, so a Neuron paper 5 years ago might not be a Neuron paper today. And it's kind of esoteric and somewhat subjective to say what the specific criteria are for that. And it's, you know, I'd say that we don't really have any rules at Neuron for, you know, we're not going to consider this subject, or we're not going to consider it unless it has, you know, this data set or this technique. I think we're all pretty open-minded. And I think part of that comes from, you know, really deeply reading each paper and really kind of deeply reading the literature in the field that goes along with each paper to kind of make an educated guess about whether the field in general would find it interesting. So, you know, I will say that there are, you know, some topics versus others we might, you know, they're kind of field dependent criteria that we'd be looking for papers. So just depending on how mature a field is. So, you know, if we're looking at kind of hippocampal based navigation and stuff like that, you know, we know that that field is very stringent and has a rich history. So we would be really looking for something that's going to kind of blow it wide open and be really cool and exciting. For a field that's not so well developed, you know, something like, let's say, how the nervous system affects production of B cells in the spleen to influence your humoral immune response. You know, that's a brand new topic, basically. So based on just how cool we think that idea is, and how new it is and how much it kind of changes people's thinking, we can just consider it cool enough to see if other people like it. Maybe just to kind of boil it down, there's not really one kind of set of hard and fast rules. We don't need new methodology. We don't need to necessarily know the impact on the world. Like, as long as it's going to be impacting the field, that will be important for us. I will say Neuron does have a reputation for rigorous and solid science, so we are pretty strict on that, but we don't make those judgments. We definitely get reviewers, the people on the ground doing the experiments who know the experiments the best. Their advice on that is invaluable. And maybe I'll just take this opportunity to plug that Neuron would not exist as it does without its reviewers. So thank you very much to all the people who review for Neuron, because you're really doing amazing work in helping shape the journal.
Great, thank you. I think that, yes, you're right. Some of the criteria, it's really hard to really set one. We need to have this mm-hmm. and this and this. And something mm-hmm. I feel like it's more like, yeah, as you said, it's educated guess. And it is something that can really bring the conceptual advances to the field. And then maybe that is what is called a criteria for the neuron.
Yeah.
So, yes. Okay. So another question is, so in China, we have a world, it's called Meijuan. It's called like a rat race, where you like people really strive to publish very high impact journals like Neurons. And if you don't publish well, you perish. So like it's kind of a like universal problem. So what do you think of people's tendency to make judgment of researchers' impacts based on their like impact factors and citation counts?
Yeah, no, I know it's a tough question, and it's one that doesn't have an easy answer, I don't think, yet. a friend of mine was recently going up for tenure at his his job at a university. So my friend made the argument, oh, but I have a cell paper. And the person on the tenure committee said, oh, but it only has 14 citations. And it's a shame. He got tenure, by the way, my friend. So good for him. But I think one of the problems is that people who are evaluating potential impact of researchers are themselves really strapped for time. And it's really hard to do a deep dive on how impactful someone's work is when you are also being asked to do a million other things. So I appreciate that. I appreciate that it's an easy way out to simply look at an impact factor or how many citations a paper gets. So I appreciate that perspective. I don't agree with that perspective necessarily. I think, there are obviously other ways that we can assess how impactful a researcher is being. You know, it's not just citations. Let's say someone's working on a rare disease. 200 people in the world have this disease, and 5 researchers in the world are working on the disease. So that paper is only going to get 5 citations, but that's going to have a huge impact on those 200 kids who have this disease. So we need to kind of think more creatively about how each individual piece of information adds to the world. Now, kind of thinking about simply beyond the publishing industry and papers, how is a scientist kind of contributing to their community? I think, you know, for PIs, are they good mentors? Are their students and trainee, their postdocs, are they happy? Are they successful? Are they doing well? Like how can we assess mentorship? Like some people are really great scientists, but really bad mentors. But if they have really high impact publications, they get kind of rewarded. And I don't know, should they be rewarded? I don't know, not necessarily, but are researchers making other contributions? Are they doing outreach in other ways? Are they, you know, encouraging their trainees to go do podcasts and write for blogs? Are they, you know, reaching out to high school students to kind of foster the next generation of scientists? Are they, you know, talking to the media or sharing their expertise on Twitter? You know, I'm not necessarily advocating for Twitter, but you know, people see it, and you know, if it's going to impact people's lives somehow, can that information be used in assessing the researcher's overall impact? You know, are they well respected within their community? Like, are they going to meetings and asking questions? And, you know, they might not have tons of papers or tons of high impact papers, but if everybody knows that they can go to this person and ask them this question, or they know, they trust the opinion of this person about some subject, you know, how can we measure that, and how can we use that information to ultimately influence someone's career path? So I guess, you know, just to summarize, you know, I understand why people are using citations and impact factor to measure research impact, but I think we need to, you know, be more open-minded and taking more holistic view of how someone is contributing to their community beyond individual papers.
I think you really offered a very realistic and comprehensive and enlightening point of view on it. And just as a concluding question, for neuroscience is a field of knowledge, and neuron is a medium and carrier of knowledge, and you editors as the kind of the yardstick of knowledge selection. What could be done to better serve and enlighten and guide the general public?
You know, as I mentioned, I when I did my undergrad, we didn't have a neuroscience program. So when I started my PhD, I was new to neuroscience, I would say. And my mentor, kind of one of the first things she said was, you need to subscribe to the Neuron Table of Contents email. So that's, I think, one of the expectations for Neuron is that we can be a source of trusted science, and science that will move the field forward. As a journal, I would say we have a role to serve in our community. So we are a reflection of our community, I would say, rather than a benchmark for our community. Does that make sense? Yeah. So we want to do what's best for the people that are our authors and our readers and our reviewers. So we don't do anything purely for the sake of ourselves or for, you know, the Journal of Neuron. We do it for the sake of you know, enriching the neuroscience community. So what more can we do? I think offering different perspectives, offering diverse perspectives, empowering people to be opinionated, not in their research papers necessarily, but we have a bunch of other forums that are appropriate for that. You know, we have a format called the NeuroView where we encourage people to share their unique perspectives on the intersections of neuroscience and society. We want to be forward-looking. We want to encourage people to be forward-looking as well. You know, we also want to bring our communities together, connect our colleagues. So, you know, we're, as I said, we also, you know, run conferences and webinars and, you know, different other things. We try to engage on social media. We have Weibo and WeChat channels as well that are, you know, trying to bring folks in who might not feel as connected to the neuroscience community as they have been in the past. So enlightening and guiding the general public is a tough thing for a journal to do. I think the best we can do, you know, especially after the last 2 years where we've seen lots of misinformation and disinformation about COVID and vaccines and health and safety measures. I think the best we can do as a journal is publish science that people can trust, and that is going to be solid. And hopefully, you know, we do have a communications department that does do press releases, and they're very mindful of not overselling things. And so we want the science to be in an appropriate context, not oversold, not saying we're going to cure Alzheimer's disease with this, you know, one study in mouse or something like that. I know it's a very complicated and nuanced question. I hope people continue to see Neuron as, you know, a good journal in the field, that they look forward to the getting the table of contents in their email inbox every couple of weeks, you know, as I did when I was a grad student, because that's sort of how I knew, you know, what was kind of interesting, where the field was moving. Just to add one other thing, sure. You know, this also kind of ties back to the data question. You know, we have tons of neuroscience data in individual papers. Now we have tons and tons of papers. So we have, you know, bioarchive and, you know, a million different journals, and it's hard to know what to read. It's hard to keep track of everything. So, you know, I hope Neuron can at least be one kind of entry point for a lot of folks to, you know, when you see the, the table of contents, you see, oh, well, I don't know anything about this subject. This looks like an interesting paper. Then you can go down the rabbit hole and look on BioArchive or look in other journals to see what else has been written on the topic. But as a curator of kind of one source of where people can gain access to seeing what's interesting and important, that Neuron can be that journal.
Yeah, that's why I love Neuron so much. I always have this in my mail list since my graduate school. So it's been almost 10 years. So yeah. I think Neuron is one of the most influential and relied upon journals in the field of neuroscience. So I really appreciate all the great work you and all your other neuron editors make to ensure every high quality paper can be seen to the world. So really a big thank you for you and for all the editors behind the scenes. So without you, we cannot see so many exciting stories going on every day.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, and, you know, to be honest, we play a relatively small part. It's the, you know, there's a lot of work that we do, but it's really, as authors, they're your papers as they're being vetted by reviewers. So we do a lot of stuff behind the scenes, but it's really Neuron is the neuroscience community's journal. It's our authors and it's our reviewers' journal. So, and we are just kind of caretakers of it. So thank you to everyone who has contributed to Neuron in some way in the past and hopefully in the future.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Tab. That's a wonderful talking with you.
Yeah. Thank you so much. You. This was really, really fun. You asked a lot of really interesting and sometimes tough questions, which is great.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I've learned a lot today. And yeah, my love for neuroscience goes deeper and deeper.
Wow. That's about as inspiring as I ever could have hoped for. So.
您刚刚收听的是神经现实旗下的播客节目《神经漫游》。神经漫游意在漫游神经与认知科学之领域，揭示认知表象与内里之趣味，由此连接业余与大众之智慧。我们强烈推荐您使用泛用型播客客户端收听我们的节目，这是第一时间听到节目并得到完整资料的最佳方法。搜索神经漫游，你也可以在网易云音乐、喜马拉雅、哔哩哔哩、荔枝 FM 和 Spotify 等平台找到我们。